especially the fuel oil prices, you know, for stove oil, that'll be hurting us during the winter months.
Bethel area residents brace for a big jump in fuel prices. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state's coastal management program starts the process of shutting down.
Doggone right, it's going to be hard to implement a program if it's reauthorized. It's not impossible, but it's certainly going to be more challenging.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
While fuel prices have gone up for months on the road system, prices in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have been frozen since last September when the last barge made it in. But as of today, prices will jump in Bethel, the region's hub. Unleaded fuel will climb 52 cents a gallon to $5.97, and heating fuel will be $6.04 a gallon, rising 72 cents. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
The first fuel barge of the season arrived in Bethel Thursday night. It docked at the Crowley Fuel Farm, carrying 1.6 million gallons of fuel. Crowley pumped the fuel all night long, and they won't stop until the barge is empty.
We're getting about 75,000 an hour, so we should be done tonight, sometime 7 o'clock maybe.
Brandon Leary is Crowley's Director of Petroleum Terminals for Alaska, but he's based out of Bethel, where he grew up.
You can see the hoses coming off the deck of the barge there. Right now we're pumping Jet A and diesel into the South Tank Farm.
The fuel barge was also carrying some unleaded gasoline. And with these new supplies of fuel comes new prices at the pump, something that residents have been anticipating for the past 9 months since the last fuel barge came in the fall. Just down the road from the Crowley barge landing and head offices is their self-serve pump station. That's where Bethel resident Rondi Beans was this Friday morning. She had heard that the barge had made it in.
That's why I'm down here filling up right now.
So did you hear about the prices?
I'm not sure how much more, at least a dollar more, so I'll just fill up the car now.
When Beans heard about the 52-cent raise, she said it's not as bad as some people were expecting, but it's still a lot of money. Her main concern, though, is heating oil.
Well, I was just thinking about trying to order more today before the price of that goes up, too.
The word there is 72 cents.
It's a blow. 72 cents for 100 gallons, it adds up.
Do you have any idea how much fuel oil you burn?
About 100 gallons every month and a half to 2 months, depending on how cold it is, how much wood we've got to supplement. So
I heard the prices were going up, and then now I heard they're going down like about 20 cents.
That's Ray Lee of Bethel. He said he's been worrying about what the prices would do this summer.
Especially the fuel oil prices, you know, for stove oil. That'll be hurting us during the winter months.
Lee says he's using an efficient Toyo stove and only uses about 50 gallons of heating oil a month. If the prices were to stay 72 cents higher, that will be $432 more for him per year. Crowley's Brandon Leary says the prices will change on Monday, so Bethel residents have a few days to stock up on fuel if they choose. He says they'll probably be getting two more fuel barges this weekend and then a few more within the week. Some of it will stay at the Crowley Tank Farm, which can hold up to 15 million gallons, but a lot of it will quickly be moved to the villages in the YK Delta.
We're getting pretty low, you know, in the springtime, of course, after running all winter. So we'll bring in a big inventory, and that starts going out to the river and out to the coast. So then fall time again, we'll top everything off.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The shutdown of Alaska's coastal management program is underway, even as some lawmakers continue to work behind the scenes to save it. Employees with the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management received layoff notices yesterday. That followed letters on Tuesday to coastal districts and state agencies that participate in the program, informing them their federal grants had been terminated. From Juneau, KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
All the legislature has to do is extend the Alaska Coastal Management Program sunset date, and the state will continue to get more than $2.5 million in federal money to help run it. Unfortunately, the deadline to do that is June 30th, and Program Director Randy Bates has no idea what will happen between now and then.
Regardless of what the legislature intends to do or promises or hopes to do, we still have closeout processes we have to follow in order to make sure that we get there.
That means the program is no longer distributing federal grants to municipalities, coastal districts, and state agencies, and nearly 30 state employees will be laid off. Bates says many of those workers have been seeking other employment since the end of the special session, when lawmakers failed to agree on a bill extending the program. Bates says the state personnel office is assisting employees to find other state jobs.
There's a number of them that have already secured other jobs. There's more that are interviewing or competing in the pools right now, so that, you know, I would say a good half of the staff right now has reasonable opportunities.
Alaska's coastal management program has been around since 1979, and for the first 25 years, it attracted relatively little controversy. Then in 2003, the Murkowski administration implemented a series of changes, supposedly to ease the regulatory process for developers. Since then, it's become something of a political football.
Ever since I've been in Juneau, practically, we've been debating coastal zone management.
Democrat Bill Wilikowski has represented Northeast Anchorage in the state Senate since 2006. He says everyone loses if the program goes away and the federal government assumes control of coastal management in Alaska.
The state will lose several million dollars in federal funds. We'll also lose millions of other dollars because there are a number of pieces of federal legislation that require states to have a coastal management plan in place in order to recover those funds. Local communities will lose their local input, and developers will lose a place where they can go to have streamlined permitting process.
Without a coastal management program, a deepwater port in the Arctic could be jeopardized. The legislature put nearly $1 million in this year's capital budget for a study of potential Arctic ports for use by the oil and gas industry. But to build such a port in federal waters, the U.S. Deepwater Port Act requires a state to have or be making progress toward an approved coastal management program. U.S. Senator Mark Begich raised the issue this week.
The state now has dropped kind of a grenade into the process and said, we're not going to do a coastal zone management plan office anymore. Well, without that, you can't do a deepwater port. Without a deepwater port, you can't service the oil and gas industry.
Negotiations to extend the coastal management program fell apart after the Senate changed a House bill to give local communities more input during the permitting process. Wilikowski says locals have certain knowledge that federal and state officials do not. He points to a dredging project in Good News Bay a few years ago.
The locals said, don't dredge in that spot because that's where the walruses haul out. We've watched the walruses haul out there for generations. That is local knowledge. Local knowledge is what the local community has observed for generations, sometimes thousands of years.
Wilikowski was on the conference committee that forged the compromise bill, which said if local knowledge conflicts with scientific evidence, the permitting agency should weigh both before making the final call.
It still is an extremely pro-development bill.
The House didn't see it that way, and twice on the last day of the special session, with five members absent, failed to pass the bill by one vote. Wilikowski says lawmakers continue to negotiate privately in an effort to hold a second special session, and he's optimistic a deal can be reached before June 30th. So far, the Parnell administration has maintained a low profile, even as it starts to shut down the program. Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan, who oversees the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management, says the administration is still trying to figure out what it will mean.
Local input's an important, very important one. And also the issue that's been raised on ports and the connection between a program and that under federal law. These are all things that we're focused on. So there's a lot of focus, and we don't have necessarily complete answers right now.
ACMP Director Randy Bates says if the legislature reauthorizes the program, it would still be possible to implement, even with the agency losing employees. But he says it would be difficult.
Doggone right. It's going to be hard to implement a program if it's reauthorized. It's not impossible, but it's certainly going to be more challenging.
If Alaska allows the current coastal management program to lapse and starts from scratch, it would take 2 or more years to get it up and running again. Once a new plan is submitted to the federal government, it takes 18 to 24 months to get approval. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska is often mentioned as rich in oil and gas and deposits of gold, but today in Washington, the state's potential for mining of rare earth elements took center stage. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the valuable minerals are used in all sorts of industries, and Congress wants the U.S. to start producing more.
Rare earth elements are highly sought after. Massachusetts Democratic Representative Ed Markey explains.
Rare earths are a group of 17 elements with unique properties that are becoming extremely important for high-tech manufacturing.
But Markey says it's not so easy to rattle them off in a list. We're not talking about gold and silver.
Most of us couldn't name a single rare earth element. But rather than trying to remember names like terbium or europium or dysprosium or neodymium, let's just call them all importium, because that's what we do. That's what we're doing. We're importing them.
2 years ago, China accounted for 97% of rare earth production, and this past year has been ratcheting back its exports for use at home. That's a problem, says Republican Congressman Doc Hastings of Washington State.
From cars to shampoos, computers to telephones, there is likely not a moment in the day that we don't use a product that is made from minerals. Even renewable and alternative energy is dependent on minerals. Wind turbines, for example, are made from zinc. Solar panels require silicon and titanium, and nuclear energy is made from uranium.
Both Republicans like Hastings and Democrats like Markey say the U.S. needs to step up its game and produce what rare earths it can. While many congressional hearings, like one earlier this week about oil drilling off Alaska, get contentious, the one about rare earths smacked of unity, and Markey noted there's agreement that the current U.S. supply is woefully inadequate.
We have to import all of them from China. This is not a wise strategy, and I sense that we're coming around to a bipartisan agreement on that.
Friday's House hearing aired two bills that would direct the U.S. Geological Survey to assess the nation's rare earth element resources. The last time there was a national assessment of minerals, it was more than 15 years ago and focused on things like gold and copper. Alaska's head of the Department of Natural Resources was on hand Friday to lend his support to the bills. Commissioner Dan Sullivan says Alaska can play a weighty role.
Alaska can and should be an important component of a national policy to address our strategic vulnerabilities. Why? Because we have world-class deposits of many of these minerals, and we rank in the top 10 in the world with regard to many of these minerals in terms of our reserves.
Sullivan touted the work being done in Alaska, including efforts toward its own statewide assessment, but he warned that the federal permitting system for getting a mine started needs to move faster. He says it only takes a couple years for a mine to get permitted in Australia, but here it can take a decade or more. That brought some pushback from Marceline Burke, deputy director at the Bureau of Land Management, who says it's not all the Fed's fault that mines take a while.
It is true that from discovery to production, that it takes 7 to 9 or 10 years. But generally, with respect to large mines, from the beginning of our processing of a plan or an application, if you will, to our decision averages about 4 years.
Dan Sullivan suggested that in order to really get things moving, the federal government have one office that shepherds companies through the permitting process. He says Alaska does that through its large project mining group.
We have a single point, an actual state official who coordinates all the permitting. And we think that that system, we have a lot of our own issues in terms of permitting reform that we're working on.
But we think that that's one area of our permitting that actually works quite well and has made it more efficient.
Sullivan says despite the cantankerous relationship Alaska often has with the feds, rare earths is an area they can work on together and meet goals across state lines and across party aisles. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, correcting the history of the bombing of Dutch Harbor.
It claims that we sunk about seven ships. We didn't even hit one.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
More than three dozen people gathered near the Talkeetna Fire Station this afternoon to meet with a state trooper and discuss the disappearance of their friend and neighbor, well-known musher Melanie Gould, who was last seen in Talkeetna at her job Monday evening. KTNA's Sue Dio reports.
Owner of Talkeetna Roadhouse, Tricia Costello, an employer of Gould, became concerned and filed a report with the Talkeetna Trooper Post on Tuesday when Gould didn't show up for work.
She would never have just left, walked off a job, you know, without a huge amount of remorse or, you know, just be mortified, you know, that. And there was no indication when I saw her on Monday afternoon.
Gould has been known in the past to leave for short periods of time. Costello became deeply concerned this time because it appeared so out of character.
Okay, we all understand that it's not a surprise, perhaps, that maybe she left. But what is a surprise and what's extremely uncharacteristic is that she left her laundry out, she left her phone, she left all of her dogs, including, you know, her most precious dog that's always with her. She left without any arrangements for having them watered or fed.
Sergeant Troy Shuey was on hand at the meeting and stood in the rain with others speaking about the disappearance.
We have no indications that anything, there's been, you know, no indications of foul play, I guess is the terminology I'm looking for, or that she's in danger by herself or anyone else. We've talked to family. She's not indicated any threats to herself or fear from anyone else.
Shuey said a welfare check was done at the residence immediately.
She wasn't at the residence. We initially entered her into our database system for anyone in the law enforcement community that comes in contact with her to notify us of her well-being.
Troopers say she was last seen on Wednesday. Shuey says they are doing whatever they can to find her and make sure she's okay. Gould's dogs have been temporarily farmed out to friends. Friends in Denali Park have started a search along Denali Highway. Posters are up in Fairbanks. Gould is 5'9", blonde and blue-eyed. She drives a 1989 blue Toyota truck with a shell. She is well-known in the mushing world. She finished in the top 20 in the Iditarod in 2006. The last time she entered an Iditarod was 2008. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Three Fort Wainwright-based soldiers killed by roadside bombs in Afghanistan last month were memorialized at an on-post ceremony yesterday. From Fairbanks, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
A traditional 21-gun salute and the playing of taps honored fallen Stryker Brigade Specialist Bradley Lewis Melton and Privates Lamoral Jerome Tucker and Chesray Presley. The combat engineers were surveying a route for improvised explosive devices when one detonated near their vehicle May 16th. Their unit leader for the last year, Sergeant Nicholas Wethington, says the three men brought more than skill to the stressful task of rooting out IEDs.
You can't ever replace their personal tributes they bring to the table, to Melton being loud and real, real out there. And Tucker was our quiet. If you heard a word, he was lucky. But if you did, you're probably going to end up laughing for a few hours because he made it count. And then Presley was our youngin', so he was definitely our handful. But that was what he always had.
Combat Engineer or Sapper units are the first to venture onto dangerous roads, and Sergeant Wethington says the job takes a special kind of person.
You're the first line, you're the first eyes, so you do have to have the nerves to do it, because you're also trying to concentrate on seeing every little detail that might have changed in your environment.
Another combat engineer, Specialist Dylan Meisner, who served with Tucker and Melton on a previous tour of duty, spoke highly of his friends.
Outstanding men, great soldiers, and they definitely were great friends. Melton was a very good father. He definitely would make you laugh, and he always had jokes. He always made everything a lot easier and a lot lighter to take. And Private Tucker, he was more so quiet. But when he did talk, he had some funny things to say, and he made sure everyone heard him, and it's a great man.
Michael DiRiccio was the driver of the bomb detection vehicle the three men killed rode in. The team was on their first patrol in Afghanistan, and DiRiccio, still recovering from injuries suffered in the explosion, says the loss of his fellow soldiers was a shock.
Well, when I first heard about it, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I was still in the hospital myself. I remember them messing with me that morning because I got sick the morning before. And they were just messing with me that entire day. And I mean, I wake up and they're not here. It's nothing else like it.
DiRiccio is rehabbing at Fort Wainwright and says he's not sure if he'll return to duty.
They say I'll have the choice once my arm heals. I mean, it's a big choice. I still don't know what I would do, really. Obviously, right after the incident, I was pretty gung-ho. I wanted to go back, but it's scary.
DiRiccio says another soldier more seriously wounded in the incident is also making progress. The three men killed were the first fatalities of the year-long deployment to Afghanistan by the 4,000-member Fort Wainwright-based Stryker Brigade. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Today marks the 69th anniversary of the Imperial Japanese Navy's bombing of Dutch Harbor. The two-day bombing raid claimed the lives of 78 Americans and 10 Japanese and began the Second World War's bloody 14-month Aleutian Islands campaign. KUCB's Jacob Resnick reports.
The deadly raid came June 3, 1942. At the time, there was little reported on the attack in the United States, though it was glorified the following year in Report from the Aleutians, a propaganda film commissioned by the U.S. Army Signal Corps and directed and narrated by famed filmmaker John Huston.
And of Dutch Harbor, American land-based planes from secret American airfields swarm down, seemingly out of nowhere, to knock out one, two troop-filled transports, three heavy cruisers, two destroyers, and one aircraft carrier.
Well, the clip that we just heard is a complete fallacy. There's not a bit of truth to it.
That's Unalaska high school history teacher Jeff Dickrell.
It claims that we sunk about seven ships. We didn't even hit one. So we barely found them and didn't even hit one.
In 2002, Dickrell published Center of the Storm, which details the Aleutian experience during the Second World War. He says, in many ways, the bombing put Dutch Harbor on the map.
Pretty much nobody had heard of it prior to that. It kind of was out there in the ether. From the turn of the century, people knew of it as a transient port. But when the bombing came, yeah, it definitely put it on the map, even though they kept it very down low.
In Unalaska, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The gray, blind hell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
A U.S. House committee passed legislation yesterday that would speed up the permitting process for Shell Oil to drill off Alaska's coast. The bill, pushed by Republicans, gained the support of five Democrats and passed the Energy and Commerce Committee 34-14. It would force the Environmental Protection Agency to move on permits and would loosen air pollution standards for offshore drilling projects. It also blocks challenges of some air permits to the EPA's Environmental Appeals Board. Shell says its plans for drilling offshore in the Arctic have been hamstrung by the permitting process, but federal officials say it's up to the company to comply with regulations before it gets the green light. Yesterday at a House subcommittee hearing, a Republican congressman from Ohio, Representative Bill Johnson, accused the Obama administration of being incompetent. He asked Shell Executive Vice President David Lawrence why he thinks permits have had delays. Lawrence said it's a problem of coordination and money.
The first is the coordination between the different agencies so that the right hand knows what the left hand is doing and assures that we are able to actually get timely delivery of those permits.
That's the competency issue.
The second thing, and that's the coordination issue. The second thing has been brought up, and I do think it's quite important that these agencies are properly resourced, to be clear, such that they can operate and go through these permits in a timely manner.
Representative Johnson disagreed that permitting departments need more funding or staff and repeated his claim that it's intentional. But the top Democrat on the Energy Committee, Representative Harry Waxman, says Shell's permits have not been ping-ponged back and forth. Despite Democratic objections, the bill pushing for a faster permitting process off Alaska's coast will now go to the House floor, where it's likely to pass. Forest fire teams continue to battle a wildfire 15 miles northwest of Fairbanks. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center says the Hastings fire has burned more than 5,800 acres between the Chattanooga River and Washington Creek west of the Elliott Highway. The Coordination Center says 363 firefighters are working to contain the fire. The wildfire at the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve is slowing. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, high winds in the forecast for this evening could change that.
Park officials say Type 2 crews were able to extinguish 50 feet of the outer western portion of the fire yesterday. Crews are expected to have another 50 feet of that extinguished by the end of the day. Despite a forecast for continued cool and moist weather, they expect winds to pick up, which could potentially spread the fire. A flyover yesterday afternoon showed the blaze generating little smoke. Since Monday night, the fire has burned over 1,400 acres at Wrangell-St. Elias. McCarthy Road remains open without driving restrictions. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick in Unalaska, and Tony Gorman in Valdez. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
AT&T. Rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266. And by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.